Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 18th, 2023 issue of the Week. This week's cover drawing is a courtroom scene. We see a seated Donald Trump from the back. We can just see his head and back. In the witness seat is Vice President Mike Pence. And standing in front of him, questioning him and pointing at Mr. Trump is Special Counsel Jack Smith. Watching over the whole scene is the judge, Tanya Chutkan. The headline is Trump's Nightmare. Can prosecutors prove that his failed coup was a crime? And that's one of our first main stories, and I believe also the controversy of the week. So we'll start with Trump battles prosecutors over January 6th evidence. What happened? Donald Trump's lawyers clashed with prosecutors this week over whether the former president can disclose evidence collected in the government's 2020 election conspiracy case, the first of many expected legal dust-ups as both sides prepare for the trial. Smith's team had asked presiding judge Tanya Chutkan to bar Trump and his attorneys from publicly sharing evidence, saying Trump might intimidate witnesses by releasing sensitive information from grand jury transcripts. Prosecutors noted that Trump last week posted a possibly threatening message on social media that read, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." Trump's lawyers said Smith's proposed protective order would muzzle their client's free speech rights and that he should be allowed to share evidence with volunteer attorneys and other unpaid advisors. Chutkan is expected to rule quickly on the protective order. Since pleading not guilty last week to charges that he conspired to derail the transfer of power after the 2020 election, Trump has attacked numerous people involved in the case. He has called Smith deranged, and Chutkan, who was randomly assigned to the case, the prosecution's number one draft pick, who must be recused. He said former Vice President Mike Pence, a potential witness, had gone to the dark side, and that getting a fair trial was impossible in filthy, crime-ridden Washington, D.C. At a New Hampshire rally, Trump promised to violate any court-mandated protective order. "They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you," he said. "I will talk about it. I will." What the columnist said: attacking judges and prosecutors is not generally recommended, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. It could even result in contempt charges. So what's Trump's grand plan, if he has any? He might be trying to goad Smith's team into prosecutorial overreach or simply playing to the court of public opinion. Still, his recent behavior suggests a man feeling cornered. It's telling that Trump thinks only some Americans can be trusted to exercise basic civic duties, said Matt Ford in The New Republic. He believes a jury in liberal Washington, D.C., where 45% of the population is black, would be inherently biased. So he wants his trial moved to deep red and 93% white West Virginia. Unfortunately for Trump, such venue changes are relatively rare. His request for the recusal of Chutkan, who is black, is also unlikely to succeed, especially given his history of hostility toward judges who rule against him. "Whenever this historical trial happens," said Stephen Brill in the New York Times, "it should be televised. Cameras aren't allowed in federal courts during criminal trials, but letting Americans witness the quiet, somber courtroom proceedings might temper the national mood. Trump haters would have to listen to the truly strong defense arguments, while his supporters would have to confront the fire hose of detailed evidence. from prosecutors about his election machinations. In our contentious, chaotic age, Americans will believe the Trump verdict only if they can see it. And a second short main story. New COVID variants fuel another wave. What happened? After months of low hospitalization rates, COVID cases have begun rising, with a new subvariant is helping to fuel the surge. Walgreens reported a 45% positivity rate on tests it administered this week, more than double the rate in April. About 9,000 people were hospitalized for COVID in the last week of July, a jump of 12% from the week before. Cases had been steadily declining until July, 2 months after the federal public health emergency expired, and with it, free testing for all. So far, this uptick lacks the intensity of previous waves, likely because of widespread immunity from prior infections and vaccines. Still, in more than 20 states, including Florida, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, new COVID hospitalizations shot up more than 20%, while in New York, cases surged 55%. Cases are also increasing in the UK, as well as parts of Asia. A new Omicron subvariant, EG5, nicknamed Eris, accounts for about 17% of new cases in the U.S., more than any other strain. The XBB Omicron subvariant is also still circulating. Eris has proved slightly more effective at getting past antibodies than other subvariants, but it doesn't appear to be more deadly. COVID deaths remain at their lowest point since the pandemic began, with fewer than 450 deaths a week. The Centers for Disease Control said that the summer wave has been expected. The U.S. has experienced increases in COVID-19 during the past three summers, said the CDC's Kathleen Conley, so it's not surprising to see an uptick. What the columnist said. We're not ready for Eris, said Eric Topol in his Substack newsletter. We were supposed to get new booster shots formulated for XBB this month, but now they may not be ready until October, well past the beginning of the school year and into cold and flu season. That's an unacceptably long delay, especially for older and vulnerable people. We've been lagging behind COVID's mutations for 3 years, instead of using our big advantage, human intelligence, to get ahead of it. We're also inexplicably failing to wield the strongest weapon in our treatment arsenal, said Lena S. Wynn in the Washington Post. The antiviral Paxlovid should be the first-line treatment, but a recent study showed that it's being given in just 1 in 4 nursing home residents who get COVID. Everyone over 65 who tests positive for COVID should take Paxlovid unless there's a medical reason why they can't. Even those who are younger should consider asking their doctors for a prescription, since researchers have found that the drug reduces the risk of developing long COVID by up to 26%. There's no shortage of Paxlovid, so there's no excuse for this life-saving tool to remain so underutilized. The good news is that we can now prevent nearly every COVID death, said Ashish Jha in the Boston Globe. With vaccines and treatments widely available, there's no reason this new surge should unduly disrupt our lives. We just need to take responsible precautions and get the latest booster as soon as it is available. And our controversy of the week, Trump, how strong is Smith's January 6 indictment? Donald Trump's attempted coup d'etat in 2020 was no doubt a moral crime against democracy and the United States, said Kevin Williamson in the Dispatch. But was it a crime in the legal sense? Unlike the so-called Mar-a-Lago documents case, where it seems easy to prove Trump illegally retained and refused to turn over classified material at his Florida estate, Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment last week, charging Trump with trying to overturn the 2020 election, is full of uncertainties and complications that make it very difficult to foresee the outcome. Trump's lawyer, John Lauro, will base Trump's defense on these uncertainties, said Ken Tran in USA Today. In TV appearances, Lauro has argued that when Trump asked Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find 11,780 votes for him, or repeatedly pressured Vice President Mike Pence to reject states' official slates of electors, he was merely exercising his right to free speech, and thus that his asks were aspirational. Besides, Lauro claims, Trump believed in his heart of hearts that he had won the election, so there was no fraud or criminal intent in his strenuous efforts to overturn it. These specious and silly defenses won't save Trump, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. If a robber tells a bank teller, "I want all the money in the vault," that too is aspirational speech, but it's also a crime, as is pressuring officials to change the result of an election. In addition, Trump didn't just express an aspiration that Raffensperger invent enough votes to declare Trump the winner. The sitting president warned a key state official that he'd face risk and would commit a criminal offense if he didn't comply. Whether Trump believed he won is legally immaterial, said Jessica Levinson in MSNBC.com. If I sincerely believe my neighbor stole my wallet, that doesn't entitle me to burglarize his home for compensation. Smith wisely focused this indictment on Trump's criminal actions. He demands that Raffensperger give him one more vote than Joe Biden, his relentless berating of Pence, and the lies he told to get fake electors to sign fraudulent paperwork are all powerful evidence of corrupt intent. It's not that simple, said David French in the New York Times. To persuade a jury Trump acted corruptly, Smith does need to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Trump knew he lost. That makes this a difficult case. Actually, Smith has all the evidence he needs, said Charlie Savage, also in the Times. Numerous credible aides and officials, including Attorney General Bill Barr, the White House counsel, and Republican governors, repeatedly told Trump there was no evidence of widespread fraud. Pence said that when he told Trump that he had no authority to unilaterally change the electoral vote count, Trump shot back, "You're too honest." When Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen told Trump there was no evidence of fraud, Trump replied, "Just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman." Clearly, if Trump was blind to his loss, his blindness was willful, said Noah Rothman in National Review. The facts show that Trump had no rational basis to believe or claim the election was stolen. By corruptly trying to keep himself in power nonetheless, he triggered one of the darkest days in his country's history, one whose damage is ongoing. This is a trial America deserves. It was a good week for monster hunters, who have been invited to a massive search of Scotland's Loch Ness for its eponymous monster. Hundreds of watchers on shore will scan the waters, while drones equipped with infrared cameras will search the 23-mile inland lake from above. It was a good week for audiophiles, with the news that Beyoncé is selling $157 listening-only tickets to her current U.S. tour. The seats, located behind the stage or sound equipment, will offer no view of the singer herself. And it was a good week for the better part of valor, after Elon Musk announced that while he's still training for a cage match with Facebook founder and martial arts student Mark Zuckerberg, he has suffered a flare-up of back pain and may need surgery before the fight can happen. But it was a bad week for the unexpected after Trader Joe's announced the recall of its unexpected broccoli cheddar soup after suppliers found an unusually high number of insects in the broccoli. It was a bad week for Saving America with the disclosure that Donald Trump's Save America PAC, which is largely funded by small donations from his supporters, paid $108,000 to Herve-Pierre Briard, stylist for Melania Trump, for strategy consulting. Finally, it was a bad week for working from home after Zoom, the video conferencing company that helped make it possible to work remotely during the COVID pandemic, ordered its employees back to the office at least 2 days a week. An in-person workforce, the company said, will better enable Zoom to use our own technologies, continue to innovate, and support our global customers. And a short and other news piece also about getting back to the office. Biden wants government workers back in offices. Biden has asked his cabinet to aggressively execute a plan to curb remote work and get more federal employees in offices this fall, according to an email sent to cabinet heads by White House Chief of Staff Jeff Zients. Political pressure has been mounting on the White House to restrict teleworking. Republican lawmakers say work from home has exacerbated backlogs at agencies, while Washington, D.C. officials say the policy is hurting local businesses. A recent report from the Government Accountability Office found that 17 of the 24 federal agencies used on average an estimated 25% or less of the capacity of their headquarters buildings. Federal employee unions may fight any mandatory rule changes. We're on the briefing. Title this week, Artificial Intelligence in the Schools. AI is transforming education from grade school to grad school and is making take-home essays obsolete. How is AI changing schooling? It's raising questions about whether age-old methods of educating people can or should survive in a world where sophisticated answers to virtually any question are just a few keystrokes away. The most popular AI tool, ChatGPT, can generate impressive essays on any subject in seconds. Stephen Chaudoin, a professor of government at Harvard, said ChatGPT produces B+, B- work, and AI is evolving rapidly. ChatGPT-4, the latest version of the chatbot, can pass the bar exam, score in the 99th percentile on the SAT's verbal section, and earn top scores on the advanced placement statistics and biology exams. As a result, some educators say the take-home essay is dead. School districts in Los Angeles and Seattle have blocked ChatGPT from their Wi-Fi networks. Some universities warn students that using AI amounts to plagiarism. Teachers from kindergarten through graduate school are divided. Some say AI is the way of the future and contend that educators must adapt to the new reality, while others speak of it in apocalyptic terms. "It's just about crushed me," an English teacher in Florida said. "With ChatGPT, everything feels pointless." Has it made it easy to cheat? ChatGPT's release led to a rash of cheating scandals, including at a high school for gifted students in Cape Coral, Florida. A Santa Clara University student was caught using the chatbot to write an essay for an ethics course. "The irony is very clearly there," said the student's professor, Brian Green, noting that the essay had a robotic feel. But even though AI-generated writing can be dry and formulaic, it's hard to know for sure that an essay wasn't drafted by a human. The chatbots essentially draw on everything on the internet, and their algorithms, whose workings are mysterious even to AI creators, churn out a somewhat different response each time they're given the same prompt. A March survey of 1,000 undergraduate and graduate students found that half of them admitted to using AI on assignments or take-home exams, with 17% admitting they turned in assignments that were completely researched and written by AI. Only half of the respondents say they consider it cheating to use AI to finish coursework and exams. Is writing instruction doomed? AI's writing still cannot match the most creative, original, and stylish writing by humans, but many educators believe it will become a standard tool anyway. The time when a person had to be a good writer to produce good writing ended in late 2022, and we need to adapt, said John Villasensor, a professor at UCLA. Anthony Allman, a professor of philosophy at Northern Michigan University, recalled reading the best paper in the class on the morality of burqa bans before growing suspicious about the essay's excellent examples, grammar, and arguments. The student admitted to using ChatGPT. Allman now plans to require students to write first drafts on classroom computers that block chatbots, then explain revisions in subsequent drafts. What are other concerns? AI frequently hallucinates and generates factually incorrect answers in a detailed, persuasive way, making up events, books, and people that don't exist. When pressed for the source of an assertion, AI sometimes cops to making things up. Fears about cheating extend far beyond English class. AI is also capable of writing code, solving math problems, and completing science homework. Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, the San Francisco-based company behind ChatGPT, likens the technology to the calculator, an innovation that required changes to how math is taught, but by no means rendered math instruction unnecessary. This is a more extreme version of that, no doubt, he said, but also the benefits of it are more extreme as well. How can it help students? Zachary Clifton, a high schooler in Kentucky, used the chatbot to generate study guides to help him understand and remember his work. Some students use AI to clean up grammar mistakes. Others debate with ChatGPT before writing an essay in order to hone their arguments. AI can offer personalized instruction and shows great promise for students with special needs. For example, AI can convert textbook material into bullet points, charts, and images to help students with dyslexia or attention deficit disorder. There's also optimism that AI can be a powerful, affordable tutoring tool. A May survey of 3,000 high school and college students found that 90% prefer studying with ChatGPT over a human tutor, and 95% said that their grades improved after studying with ChatGPT. What about teachers? Overworked teachers can use AI to create lesson plans, grade assignments, and generate multiple choice questions. AI can offer personalized assistance to students as they work to complete assignments. Jacqueline Major, a sixth grade teacher at Khan Lab School in Palo Alto, California, uses ChatGPT to help teach math, even though it occasionally makes obvious mistakes. Remember, we are testing it, she tells her students. We're learning, and it's learning. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Trump's lifetime of racism. How fitting that Donald Trump now faces a charge of violating the Ku Klux Klan laws, said Will Bunch. The January 6th indictment includes the charge that by attempting to negate the votes of millions of people in cities with large black populations, like Atlanta, Detroit, and Philadelphia, Trump violated statutes from the 1870s aimed at the KKK's efforts to disenfranchise black citizens. In fact, Trump's entire public career was built on white supremacy. His father, Fred, was arrested in 1927 for joining 1,000 KKK members marching through Queens, New York. In 1973, the federal government sued Fred and Donald for discriminating against African Americans seeking to rent their apartments. The younger Trump sought to raise his political profile in 1989 with a full-page newspaper ad demanding the death penalty for five black teens accused in a Central Park rape case. They were later exonerated. In 2011, Trump falsely claimed that the country's first black president was born in Africa and was thus ineligible. His 2016 campaign was based on exploiting fears about Muslims and Mexicans. In 2020, Trump's defenders attacked the Capitol while waving Confederate battle flags. There is a straight line between the KKK and the twisted presidency of Donald Trump. Democrats dust off Harris. Kamala Harris is coming off the sidelines, said Olivier Knox. The vice president has hit the road in recent weeks, visiting electorally critical states like Iowa, Florida, and Wisconsin to make a ringing defense of abortion access and to launch caustic attacks on how schools in Ron DeSantis' state teach the history of slavery. Harris has struggled for visibility as vice president, and her approval ratings lag at 40%. But with the 2024 presidential race underway, Biden's campaign is sending her out to energize core Democratic constituencies. Those include black women, pro-choice women, and young people, many of whom are less than enchanted with Biden and the country's direction, but view Harris warmly. Harris' flurry of activity suggests the administration wants to rehabilitate her reputation and use her as a rapid response team to highlight Republican extremism on guns, abortions, and race. Harris, of course, will be a lightning rod for Republican attacks, and the claim that a vote for the aging Biden is a vote for a Harris presidency. Her fiery speeches alone will not fix Biden's own poor approval ratings, but Democrats clearly want her to be part of the solution. This column comes from the United Kingdom. Utter anarchy as thieves loot our stores. Britain is in the grip of a retail crime frenzy, said Chris Blackhurst. From box stores in London to tiny shops and villages, looters are running riot, bursting in and grabbing whatever they can on an almost daily basis. It is most frightening when the criminals clamber over the kiosks, one manager at Co-op, a large grocery chain, told me. Shoplifting has always been there, but this is different. They just sweep the products off the shelves. These aren't teenagers pocketing a lipstick or a beer. The thieves of today are making a career of it, and they'll be putting the stuff up for sale on the internet by day's end. The scale of their theft is staggering. Every single day through June of this year, Co-op recorded almost 1,000 crimes across its 2,500 outlets, ranging from pilfering to violent assault. And that's just one British retailer. Overwhelmed by the volume of calls, police can respond to only about one quarter of retail thefts. So companies are now spending hundreds of millions of dollars on whatever they can buy to protect themselves. CCTV, security guards, and even dummy packaging on shelves. We need the police to play their part. That will mean more officers on the streets and new laws to prosecute petty theft. The looters won't stop until they're forced to. And the last word, our feature article, title this week is 50 Years of Supernatural Chutzpah. Uri Geller, infuriated and exasperated critics set on debunking his claims of psychic powers, said David Segal in the New York Times. Now his one-time foes concede they missed the point. In 1973, a young man named Uri Geller appeared on one of the BBC's most popular television shows, the Dimbleby Talk-In, and announced that the laws of Newtonian physics did not apply to him, or that at least was the implication. A handsome 26-year-old Israeli, dressed casually and flanked by a pair of academics, Geller performed a series of bewildering feats using nothing more, he said, than his mind. He restarted a stopped watch. He duplicated a drawing that had been sealed in an envelope. Then he appeared to bend a fork simply by staring at it. "It's cracking," Geller said quietly, speaking over a tight shot of his right hand, which was gently rubbing the fork between his fingers. "It's becoming like plastic." A few seconds later, the top of the fork fell off and hit the ground. By the time the applause of the studio audience died down, Geller mania had begun. Geller became not just a global celebrity, a media darling who toured the world and filled auditoriums for dramatic demonstrations of cutlery abuse, with a humble spoon becoming his victim of choice, but also the living embodiment of the hope that there was something more, something science couldn't explain. Because at the core of his performance was a claim of boggling audacity that these were not tricks. They were displays of raw psychic power. "I've never even seen a magic show," Geller, now a lean and tireless 76-year-old, said during a recent interview in Tel Aviv at the Uri Geller Museum, which he opened in 2021, "except one, Siegfried and Roy in Las Vegas, because I missed a flight." Charm and a seemingly bottomless supply of chutzpah were essential to his fame, and with fame came a one-man, multi-million-dollar enterprise built on sales of tickets and books and the reality TV show The Next Uri Geller, which had versions in Israel, the United States, and Europe. "It's a fortune he might have never earned," he said, without a group of highly agitated critics. Geller was long shadowed by a handful of professional magicians, appalled that someone was fobbing off what they said were expertly finessed magic tricks as acts of telekinesis. Like well-matched heavyweights, they pommeled one another in the 70s and 80s in televised contests that elevated them all. Geller ultimately emerged the victor in this war, and proof of his triumph is now on display in the museum, a coffee table book titled Bend It Like Geller, which was written by Australian magician Ben Harris. Time to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the talk-in appearance, the book celebrates Geller as a brilliant and highly original magical entertainer, a significant change of heart for Harris, who was once among Geller's most avid debunkers. Today, Harris and Geller are friends who text or talk nearly every day. Harris looks back at his 1985 attack book, Gellerism Revealed, as the work of an angry young man who had missed the point. And the point is that Geller is an entertainer, one who'd figured out that challenging our relationship to the truth and daring us to doubt our eyes can inspire a kind of wonder, if performed convincingly enough. Geller's bent spoons are, in a sense, the analog precursors of digital deepfakes, images, videos, and sounds reconfigured through software so that anyone can be made to say or do anything. A sloping 53-foot, 11-ton spoon made of rusting steel sits outside the Uri Geller Museum in the ancient neighborhood of Old Jaffa. Throughout the day, tourists gather to gawk at the sculpture, and when Geller spots them, he often bounds down a flight of stairs to say hello and offer a quick performance. "Where are you from?" he asks a group of Austrians who gathered there one afternoon in May. As they answered, he quickly began to rub a spoon, which appeared to droop in his hands, that he autographed and tossed into the crowd, like a bouquet of flowers at a wedding. "Thank you for coming to Israel," he shouted as he walked off to a round of applause. The impromptu show lasted about a minute. He came, he bent, he left. Geller is less dogmatic about claims to otherworldly gifts now, preferring to call himself a mystifier. Time and again, he emphasized his chops as a performer, a man who could mesmerize an audience largely through ad-libbed interactions and charisma. When young magicians come and ask for advice, he suggests what amounts to a makeover. I tell them, wear Armani t-shirts, buy Hermes aftershave, fix your teeth, smile a lot, be nice to people, he said, sitting in his chair in the middle of the museum. This is the way to become famous and loved by your audience. Geller never retired, although he doesn't travel much anymore, and spends nearly every day here, giving group tours, no walk-ins, please, to roughly 250 people each week. Geller is self-professed hoarder, and the museum is essentially the contents of his attic, or a few storage bins tastefully laid out as a permanent exhibition. He spent $6 million buying and 4 years refurbishing the Ottoman-era soap factory, an investment Geller knows he will never recoup. Geller and Hannah, his wife of 52 years, decided in 2015 to leave England, where the couple had raised their two now-adult children. The family had lived in a 9-bedroom mansion in a village outside London, with a jacuzzi, tennis court, helicopter pad, and glass meditation pyramid. His next-door neighbor was George Clooney. Jimmy Page lived down the street. The house is on the market for the equivalent of just under $10 million. In Britain, Geller maintained a sort of profile that got him invited to appear on the TV show I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, as he found endless ways to insert himself into the news, offering to stop Brexit telekinetically, taking credit for dislodging the tanker that was stuck in the Suez Canal. "I'm the best publicist in the world. Come on," he said matter-of-factly. "You can promote Coca-Cola. You can promote a car. It doesn't matter, as long as you use my techniques, which are brilliant." One early Geller devotee was Harris, who watched the Dimbleby show from his grandparents' home in Sydney. He was 15 at the time and already a performing magician. After the broadcast, as instructed by Geller, he went to the kitchen, grabbed a utensil, and willed it to Ben. "It did. I was totally sucked in," he said in a recent phone interview. "If it had been presented as a magic trick, I would have figured it out immediately. But this was something else, something standing on the edge of the unknown. It was also something new. Psychic metal bending wasn't among the dozen or so genres of magic like card tricks or levitation, and this guy didn't dress the part. He wore street clothes and lacked a patter. Briefly, Harris said, he imagined a better world, one in which the energy crisis was solved in part by mind power. Because if one guy could bend a fork, who knows what a few million people could achieve? By 1976, Harris was becoming a doubter. That year, he attended a Geller show in Brisbane, Australia, along with about 4,000 others, and remembers an eccentric, riveting performance with a tray of spoons and keys provided by the audience and stretches of silence punctuated by inexplicable bends. After the show, Harris managed to get backstage, the first and only time he met Geller in person. He handed him a matchbox wrapped in tinfoil and tape, containing a piece of metal. "It was a challenge from a hyperactive young man," Harris said during a recent video call with Geller. He started to unravel it, then said, "No, no, no, you take it home, unravel it. See if it's bent and let me know. It was not bent. By then, Harris realized that the slight anomaly in his grandparents' spoon 3 years early had been there all along. Like many collections of well-worn utensils, they varied in curvature. Harris felt hoodwinked, which is why the book Gellerism Revealed is infused with a rage of disillusionment. I basically call him a fraud and a charlatan, he said. James Randi, a Canadian magician and escape artist, known professionally as the Amazing Randi, went much further. A relative unknown at the time, Randi, who was eventually won a MacArthur Fellowship as a professional skeptic, was the loudest anti-Geller voice in the world. He is intending to enter the psychic healing field soon, and when he starts into that racket, he can kill people, he wrote in an edition of his book, The Truth About Uri Geller. He also called Geller a dangerous and insidious figure, one he intended to stop at all costs. Those costs, it turned out, were high. Geller filed defamation lawsuits against Randi, including one for claiming that Geller was performing tricks once taught on the back of cereal boxes. The so-called Cornflakes case ended with a dismissal, but over the years, Randi burned through most of his $272,000 MacArthur grant covering personal legal expenses. He died 3 years ago and apparently loathed his nemesis to the end. He once asked someone throw his cremated ashes into Geller's eyes, an obituary in The Economist stated. Geller had relocated to Britain by then, having spent 12 tumultuous years in the United States, most of them in New York City, before relocating to Britain in the mid-80s. In the U.S., he had gotten rich, but he wasn't equipped for money or fame on this scale, and he was rattled by the verbal assaults. He struggled with panic attacks and became anorexic and bulimic. He also shopped compulsively, once buying 100 silk shirts during a visit to a Brioni store in Milan, few of which he ended up wearing. It was decadence, he said. I had 10 Gucci suitcases, leather Gucci suitcases. Do you know how much they cost? Geller gradually regained his mental equilibrium, although his taste for luxury proved hard to shake. When he moved to Britain, a relative suggested it would be a better place to raise a family. He fell in love with a house in Sonning, a village 40 miles west of London, because it reminded him of Graceland and the White House. He more than doubled the square footage of the place, adding bedrooms, a cinema room, and gold-plated bathroom fixtures. At some point, about 6 years ago, it all started to seem berserk. I just looked at the marble and the crystal chandeliers, he said of Sonning Court, as the house is known, and I thought, I've got to get out of this. He wanted to radically downsize, he said, and today he lives in a one-bedroom apartment not far from where he grew up. He has settled where he began. On the off chance that he can't truly bend metal with his mind, he has done something less miraculous, but nearly as implausible. He has earned a very comfortable living for 50 years performing what is essentially the most acclaimed party trick of all time. Now and then he speaks to magicians, giving tips and what are essentially motivational speeches. Be original, be persistent, stick with a persona, he tells listener. At the Blackpool Magic Convention in February 2020, he gave all that advice to a packed room, and he performed a newish effect. He poured radish seeds into his hands and asked everyone to chant sprout over and over. As he swirled the seeds with a finger, a close-up camera showed a green shoot that seemed to materialize in the middle of his hand, as if it had been willed to blossom. Among magicians, asked a cheeky young man during the question and answer part of the presentation, was that a magic trick? Did you sneak a bit of cress in with your seeds? Are you serious? Geller all but shouted, more amused than gauzed. Do you really think I'm going to say at the age of 73 that this was a trick? Get a life. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. On the Health and Science page, we have how the Voyager 2 mission was saved. NASA managed to reestablish contact with Voyager 2 by using a huge radio array on Earth to call to it across the void of space, reports space.com. The craft is currently more than 12 billion miles away, hurtling toward the edge of our solar system. Last month, the controllers operating it mistakenly sent it a command that tilted its antenna a couple of degrees away from Earth and cut off communications entirely. Radio antenna on the ground picked up a faint heartbeat signal, proof that the Voyager 2 was still operating, but the craft couldn't send any data. Engineers sent it a command to reposition itself, using one of NASA's Deep Space Network satellite dishes in Canberra, Australia, a painstaking process that involved delays of 37 hours as the signal traveled at the speed of light across the vast distance and back. The wait was pretty nerve-wracking, said project manager Suzanne Dodd. You don't sleep well. But then the terminals lit up as the craft began once again sending data, and Mission Control in California erupted in high fives and joyful tears. Launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida in 1977, Voyager 2 is the only spacecraft to study all four gas giants at close range, and it discovered the first known extraterrestrial oceans and volcanoes on two moons of Jupiter. The craft runs on a nuclear battery that converts the heat from radioactive decay into electricity, but after nearly 50 years in service, that power supply is dwindling, and some of its instruments have been shut off. Women were hunters, too. Early human ancestors were hunter-gatherers, but that doesn't mean men hunted and women gathered. Increasingly, skeletons buried with weapons that were assumed by an earlier generation of archaeologists to be male are turning out to be female. Now, a new study adds to evidence that hunting was usually a co-ed endeavor, reports NPR.org. Researchers looked at 391 foraging societies across the world dating back to the 1800s. They found data on hunting for 63 societies. In about 80% of those, women as well as men hunted. And most of the time hunted intentionally rather than opportunistically, killing animals while doing something else. Women in these societies also used a wider variety of weapons and strategies than their male counterparts, such as hunting in groups, not just alone or in pairs. And in societies where hunting was crucial to survival, women were involved 100% of the time. Women had their own toolkit, said co-author Kara Wall Scheffler from Seattle Pacific University. They had favorite weapons. Grandmas were the best hunters in the village. And on the Talking Points page, music. Why are fans pelting performers? This concert season might go down as the summer of hurling objects, said Brittany Wong in HuffPost. In recent months, gig-goers have thrown a barrage of projectiles, from jewelry to vape pens, sex toys, and even bags of cremated human remains, at artists including Harry Styles, Kelsey Ballerini, Pink, and Drake. Hit by a drink at recent Las Vegas show, rapper Cardi B retaliated by chucking her microphone at the concert goer. This feral atmosphere is putting performers on edge, said August Brown in the Los Angeles Times. Bebe Rexha needed stitches after being struck in the eye by a cell phone during a New York show in June. The alleged assailant told police he thought hitting Rexha would be funny, adding, "It's a TikTok trend." A day later, in Los Angeles, a man stormed the stage and slapped pop singer Ava Max. Paul Wertheimer, a concert security expert, worries it's only a matter of time before a performer is seriously hurt. You just don't know which shows are safe and which aren't anymore, he says. Blame social media, said Anna Hanks in the Dallas Morning News. The pandemic moved people's lives totally online, and many remain hooked on the virtual world and its perverse incentives. Viral fame seekers know they can achieve social media glory by being caught on camera, connecting with famous performers, even if that connection comes in the form of a hurled cell phone. Audience members have been throwing things on stages, flowers, underwear, as long as there have been stages, said John Caramanica in the New York Times. But in the age of social media, this cluster of incidents feels like a game of one-upsmanship. Selfies with stars are no longer enough. Disrupting a celebrity, inserting yourself into their narrative, may be the ultimate concert souvenir. It can't be overstated how much this sucks, said Rob Sheffield in the Rolling Stone. Performers are human beings who deserve safety. Will more follow the lead of Miley Cyrus, who announced in May she would stop touring? Will venues have to turn into airport security hellholes with body cavity searches? Following the lifted COVID restrictions, this summer gave us the chance, again, experience the mass rapture of the live show and the fragile temporary community conjured by performers and fans. But those moments only happen when there's mutual trust and respect, and they can't even begin when the performer can't trust the audience. Drugs, Oregon's decriminalization experiment. How soon is too soon to call a progressive and libertarian policy obsession a public policy fiasco? Asked Brett Stevens in the New York Times. In 2020, Oregon voters overwhelmingly passed a ballot measure to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of hard drugs. Under the new policy, known as Measure 110, people caught with less than a gram of heroin or less than 2 grams of methamphetamine can be fined $100. The penalty is waived if they call a treatment hotline. Supporters of decriminalization claimed Measure 110 would reduce overdose rates, shrink racial inequities in the justice system, and help addicts get clean. They were wrong. Opioid overdose deaths in Oregon rocketed from 280 in 2019 to 745 in 2021. And fewer than 40 people interested in treatment called the hotline in its first 2 years. In Portland, addicts now shoot up in public, and needles and feces litter the streets. Unsurprisingly, a recent poll found that 63% of Oregonians want to bring back criminal penalties for drug possession. If Oregon's overdose surge is a result of decriminalization, then why did overdoses also rise in prohibitionist state? Asked Jacob Sullum in Reason. Nationwide, there were 107,000 drug-related deaths in 2021. That's 50% more than in 2019, and possibly a result of the pandemic and the increased availability of the potent opioid fentanyl. Measure 110's real failing is that it didn't also address the supply of illegal drugs, which remain just as iffy and potentially deadly as they were before the initiative was approved. Nearly everyone agrees that this bold reform effort hasn't gone as planned, said Jim Hinch in The Atlantic. But state funding is only starting to flow to treatment centers, and advocates say Measure 110 simply needs more time to prove itself. The problem is that Oregon's decriminalization effort has lots of carrot but no stick, said Germán López in The New York Times. Drug addiction is an illness, but addicts often do not want treatment. They frequently think they have a handle on their drug use. By ending the threat of the arrest and prison time and not replacing that with something more forceful than an easily avoidable fine, Oregon has no way to push addicts toward the treatment they desperately need. The U.S. spent decades criminalizing drug use and disproportionately locking up Black, Hispanic, and Native Americans. That approach was deeply flawed. Oregon's experience shows there are also downsides to going to the other extreme. On the poll watch, we have 45% of Republicans say they would not vote for Donald Trump if the former president were convicted of a felony crime by a jury, while 35% said they would still support him. 52% of Republicans said they would not vote for Trump if he were in prison on Election Day. 28% said they would. 75% believe the indictment of Trump on criminal charges is politically motivated. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from John Milton, quoted in The Millions, who says, "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven." With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.